The subject matter here, jurisdictional warfare. Now what that relates to is going into the courtroom and challenging or overcoming the jurisdiction that they bring against you, whether it be a traffic ticket, whether it be a land issue, a home building issue, a tax issue, whatever the issue is. You'll have to determine, like I said, we have other tapes out. I'm going to assume that you've seen some of these other tapes on some of these other issues. This tape here, we're not going to get into that. Here we're going to concentrate only on jurisdiction. And we even went in the tape entitled Church Sovereignty, we spoke about jurisdiction and where it actually comes from and what it actually means. So we're going to just assume that you understand what jurisdiction is. In brief, it's the authority that they have to impose compliance from you. Okay? If they have jurisdiction over you, they can do that. And we are going to go through here and find out whether it is possible to go into the courtroom and challenge jurisdiction. Find out whether you should even be in the courtroom or if your appearance there, if you waive your jurisdictional objection. We'll find out some of these things. We'll find out whether challenging jurisdiction is a privilege or a right. These are the things that we're going to zero in on. Now, before we start on that, I'm going to go to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which in your state, you also have rules of civil procedure, and you're going to have to look them up in your own rules. But they pretty much all read the same as far as this next subject that I'm going to address. This is ORCP, Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 2. Okay? One form of action. There shall be one form of action known as a civil action. All procedural distinctions between actions at law and suits in equity are hereby abolished. Now, what have they abolished? It says, well, all the procedural distinctions between the two. They didn't say that the at-law was abolished, just the procedural distinctions. Then it says, except for the distinctions specifically provided for by these rules, by statute, or by the Constitution of this state. Now, that means that there is common law in these statutes. The old common law, which stems from the laws of Moses and the Ten Commandments, the old common law is still embodied in these state statutes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's analyze it. Murder is a common law offense. That statute against murder still exists in the statutes. So the common law is not gone from the statutes. It's still in there. Although they have the equity, administrative equity has overpowered the strength and full force of the common law. Now, what really is, we have to address here what our real objective is here. There are patriots who feel that it's a good thing to go into the courtroom and do battle and adjudicate their issue in the courtroom and then have it go up through the appellate process, and it takes months, sometimes years, to get a final decision. Some patriots think that's a good thing, okay? The objective here is really to avoid all those types of confrontations. I want to acquaint you with an individual here. This is the individual that I'm going to talk about right now. This individual is Joe Patriot. Now, this is where he finds himself every once in a while. As you can see here, his cell is marked Patriot. And over here, it says, I want my rights. Okay, now this is what can happen to you if you do not understand how to challenge jurisdiction and you do not understand the issues. Now, a lot of people have ended up here. I'm one of them. I was there once. And this is something that we're trying to avoid. As a patriot, you don't want to end up here. And as a believer, you certainly don't want to end up there. You don't even want to be in the court arguing issues before the court, trying to get them to recognize and give you a decree or a judgment or some sort of recognition that you have rights at law. Now, you can do that. I mean, if you want to spend your time doing that, you certainly can, and you may even get to the bottom of some of the issues. However, the object of this tape is not to do that. The object is, if you are confronted with the system, they try to give you a ticket, or they try to red tag you, or whatever it is they're trying to do. The object here is to go in, challenge jurisdiction, or put up a jurisdictional bar, and that's the end of it. You walk off, there's no further litigation, and well, there can be no litigation, there's no jurisdiction, there's no appeal, there's no nothing. The case is over, right there. You go on about your business till the next confrontation. See, this only takes, at the most, 1 or 2 days, rather than 1 or 2 years. Now, if you're into suing the people in the system and trying to get a monetary judgment against them, well, you can get into that too. You can, have them to damage you, and then you go ahead and sue them afterwards. But it is our position here that we're quickly running out of time for endless litigation in the courtroom, suing people, trying to get judgments, and all those kinds of things. There are some other things coming down the pike that we have to address, which have nothing to do with being involved in those synagogues of Satan called the courts, trying to get remedy at law. And you'll find that that's the wrong place to try to get remedy at law to begin with. Okay, we've determined that there is still some common law in the statutes, in your state codes. It's still in there. You have to dig it out. Let's talk here about jurisdiction. I've got a little flyer here. This flyer is going to accompany the paperwork packet, or even the paperwork packet that goes with this tape. And this flyer says, it has a simple thing on it that says, all the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. That's what it says. All the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. Now, that may or may not be hard for you to accept, but it's the beginning of understanding what you're involved in. They need your consent, your permission, your act and your deed, your signature, your covenant, your contract, whatever it is, they're getting jurisdiction from you somehow. They're getting consent from you somehow. They're getting your permission to move forward against you. So the place to look is not at them, the place to look is at yourself. What are you doing that is giving them jurisdiction? That's where you have to, what you have to look at. So let's put this up here, and we're going to refer back to it from time to time so that we can stay on point and remember what it is that we are talking about. What we're going to talk about now is there are a few things that we need to know about jurisdiction. Okay? First of all, if you change your status, now we're not going to talk about how to change your status. We're going to assume that you already know how to do that. We're now going to proceed from the understanding that you've changed your status and you're out of the system. If you're going to do that, that means that the system no longer has jurisdiction over you. That's basically what that means. So therefore, since they don't have any jurisdiction over you, you pretty much are responsible to follow some sort of law. Okay? Now, there's a basic understanding for a believer, and that is that there can be no liberty without the law. There can be no freedom without the law. So in other words, just because you're not under the jurisdiction of the system, you are under someone's jurisdiction. You are under the jurisdiction of something. Otherwise, you would end up being jurisdictionless. And that's kind of what happened to the buffalo. So you got a bunch of people out there who don't answer to anybody, and they just started slaughtering off the buffalo. That's part of the problem. They didn't feel that they had to answer to anybody for that. All they had to do was answer to themselves. Now, this is not what we are advocating here at the church. We don't want you to just go do your own thing, not answer to the jurisdiction of the system, not answer to anybody's jurisdiction, and you just rule yourself, and you decide what you do. That's not what it's about. We're not here to create jurisdictionless sovereigns, put it that way. Okay, then whose jurisdiction are we then under? Well, let's go to Revelation chapter 1, verse 6. And it reads this way. And hath made us kings and priests unto God and his Father. Now, the next sentence is extremely important. To him be the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Now, dominion, this word dominion, if you research that out, you find out that dominion is practically synonymous with jurisdiction. So the jurisdiction is to the Almighty. That's who has the jurisdiction. Now let's run that down a little bit more. Let's go to Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. Exodus chapter 19, verse 4 reads this way. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Verse 5 reads this way. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant is a contract that we have with our sovereign, the Almighty, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people. Then the next sentence is, for all the earth is mine. In other words, he has dominion and jurisdiction over all the earth, all the substance, all the living creatures, everything. Okay? There's no question about that if you're a believer. If you accept that, then you will understand that you are under the jurisdiction of something, the Almighty. Okay? He is the supreme sovereign. Only through him do we enjoy our freedoms at law. Only through him do we enjoy sovereign status of a sovereign inhabitant. Okay? That's an understanding that we need to come to here. Now, if you want more detailed explanation of how that can be put into actual practice, you need to get the tape called The Sovereignty of the Church, which explains how the church, through the Lord, through the church, down to you, you can exercise your ambassadorial immunity under the jurisdiction of the Almighty. That's what it's talking about. But what we're going to do here is concentrate on what do I do if I'm confronted by the system? What can I do? People have said, well, I've tried to challenge jurisdiction, and pretty much now I've heard some disturbing things in the Patriot Movement. One of which is that I was told, and I won't say, you know, who the person is or party is that said this, but I was told that none of the jurisdictional challenges are working, that the only way that you can even begin to make a case in the courts right now is if you hire, you do all the work, you put all the issues in a row and put it all in order and then give it to an attorney so an attorney can argue it for you. That's what's happening. That's the reports I've been getting from California. That's what they do. They just go get an attorney to argue their issue. And I say, if you don't do that, why, you can't possibly win. Okay? We're going to use some examples here, and we're going to dispel some things that you may have believed and replace them with some hard, cold facts. One of the things that I'd like to really get out of the way right now, which I believe to be important, is the issue of the birth certificate. Now, there are some people who in the Patriot Movement who believe that the birth certificate is of no significance to your status. And we are here to tell you that the birth certificate is a very key issue in the status situation. It's a key issue in the challenging of jurisdiction, the putting up of a jurisdictional bar, and the doing all of these things at law. It is a key situation. Now, basically what we're saying here is, what is the sense in going out and challenging jurisdiction if you don't have your status right? That's what we're saying. What's the sense in trying to assert allodial rights at law, at the substantive law, if you don't have your status right? What's the sense in doing any of these things if you don't have your status right? Now, we are not saying that these other things aren't important. Social Security, driver's license, marriage license, so on and so forth. These things have to be done away with. But the birth certificate is a key and crucial contract. If you want to, actually, it's not a contract. The contract itself is the Constitution of the United States. That's the contract. It's the contract between the sovereign people and the government to keep the government in line. And it is a contract for the government and not for the sovereign. Okay? The contract, the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, was altered and they deviated from it by the 14th Amendment. They actually breached the contract with the 14th Amendment. All right? Now, this 14th Amendment came in 1868, right after the Civil War. And you'll also find that birth certificates came in 1868, right along with the 14th Amendment. Now, you can say, you may well say, well, that's neither here nor there. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. Well, I think that it's quite a coincidence that the birth certificates came in at the same time as the 14th Amendment. And the obvious question that you would ask is, what did they do before the birth certificates were there? You mean people weren't born before the 14th Amendment because they didn't have a birth certificate? See? The conversation can break down real fast. Well, then that's what you should ask somebody who says, oh, the birth certificate, that's just a record, and it's just a public notice of when you were born and where you were born. That's all it is, and who your parents were. Well, it goes a lot further than that. The birth certificate is the evidence that the 14th Amendment applies to you. That's what it is. Now, if you want your rights at law, if you want to be a sovereign, if you want to do all of these things, you want to be out of the system, you don't want the 14th Amendment to apply to you. Because the 14th Amendment gives you civil rights, not rights at law. It makes you a subject of government, not a sovereign over government. So the birth certificate is something that you must rescind and do away with if you are to get yourself in the proper position. Now, like I said, if I was to put them in order of importance, I would say that the first and most important document or rescission that you must handle is the birth certificate. Next, beyond that, is the Social Security. That is the next highest in importance, and then on down from there. Okay, enough said about the birth certificate and status. All right, now, like I said, jurisdiction. We're going to run through, and we're going to explain where does the jurisdiction start? What do we do and how do we circumvent the beginning of this jurisdiction? Well, for that we're going to use an example. Let me use I'll use a piece of paper here. And I'll take the card out of my wallet here. This happens to be my remnant church ID card. I've got an ID card which we make ourselves. It's just a remnant church ID card. Okay, we use that to identify ourselves when we want to identify ourselves to the system. Now, let's assume that this is a driver's license, and this is a citation. Let me explain also, I'm an ex-police officer. That's what I did before I got into the movement, and so I'm quite familiar with how this is done and what the basis for it is. You hand the police officer your license, and he takes it, and he writes you a traffic ticket. And then he takes the traffic ticket, he folds it up, and he puts your license in the traffic ticket, and then he hands you the ticket, like this. And of course, you put your hand out, you want your license back, so you grab the ticket and the license, and now you've got the ticket and the license. Now, why does he do that? Why do they train police officers to do that? Well, the reason is, and this is a fact, that jurisdiction attaches once the summons, this is a summons, jurisdiction attaches once the summons touches you. All right? That means that all he really has to do is take the ticket, the citation, and touch you with it, and he can then let it fall on the ground. Once it touches you, that's it. Jurisdiction has attached right there. And that's kind of appropriate, okay? It's interesting what can happen if you don't let the summons touch you. All right? I did that. I worked the situation out. I'm not going to go into details, but the end result of it was the state police put out the summons and complaint, the ticket, and it never touched me. It went to somebody else. And I challenged that the summons never touched me, therefore jurisdiction didn't attach. And it was interesting how the argument worked in the court. Okay? You can try that, but if it's not possible for you to do that, don't worry about it. It's enough that you know that the summons itself touching you is jurisdictional. Now, let's analyze then what is the
beginning of the jurisdiction. Well, usually the jurisdiction, most things start at the beginning. Okay? That's a very simple concept. Where does the beginning of the problem of your status really start? Well, it really starts when you're born and you get a birth certificate, right at the beginning. You don't get a social security number at the beginning, although that's going to happen too, but you get the very first thing that happens, the very first legal action that happens, is you get a birth certificate. That's the beginning. So you have to go through the beginning to correct the problem. Where does your problem with jurisdiction attaching to you, a jurisdiction you don't want to attach to you, where does it start? Well, it starts at the beginning. It starts when he hands you the summons. Now there's jurisdiction. Okay? Now let's go to this that I'm going to be reading from is jurisdiction. It's entitled jurisdiction. It comes from jurisdiction in a nutshell that's put out by West Publishing Company. Now let me read here what the Penoyer decision had to say. Jurisdiction in personam. Individuals. The Penoyer rule. Now, I suppose I should, well, I'll just spell it out for you. It's P-E-N-N-O-Y-E-R. It's Penoyer versus Neff. It's an 1878 case. It says, in 1878, the Supreme Court of the United States established the rule that a court may take personal jurisdiction over the defendant only and always if process was served on him personally within the state. Penoyer versus Neff, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case. Okay, now, we found something out here. We found out that service of process is absolutely crucial to the attachment of jurisdiction. Now, what else does it say in here? Let me read you some other startling things that you may not have known, which you'll see are going to become very important to an understanding of jurisdiction. Okay, out of the same book, it says, once jurisdiction is acquired, it continues throughout the same litigation. All right? That's a Michigan Trust case. It's a 1913 case. All right? Now, what we need to get into here and understand is, once jurisdiction is acquired, it continues throughout the same litigation. Now, we have heard before that you can challenge jurisdiction at any time. And that's true. You can challenge jurisdiction at any time. But it says here, once jurisdiction is acquired, it continues throughout the same litigation. All right, sure, you can challenge jurisdiction at any time, but it only has meaning when you challenge jurisdiction at the beginning before anything has happened in the case. All right? Not to say that the courts can't voluntarily reverse a decision of theirs if they want to, based on your jurisdictional challenge brought years later. They can do that if they want to. But if they don't want to, and if you're talking about traffic tickets and Patriot issues and cases brought against Patriots, you must defeat the jurisdiction at the beginning. If you try to challenge jurisdiction later, sure, Supreme Court said you can challenge jurisdiction at any time. But is it worth anything? The answer is no. It's not worth a thing. Because jurisdiction, once it's acquired, it continues throughout the same litigation. All right? Now, that means that we had better overcome the jurisdiction at the beginning if we're going to overcome it at all. That's before we put in any motions, before we're arraigned, before the court rules in any manner on anything. It has to start at the beginning. What did we find out was the beginning? Well, the beginning is the summons. That's the beginning. All right? We're going to read some quotes out of here and discuss them a little bit. A citizen of a foreign country briefly visits the United States. While here, he is sued in a state court by an American. Although the cause of action is alleged to have grown out of business relations abroad, the state gets good jurisdiction over the foreigner to render an in personam judgment if he was served with process within the state. Okay? This is kind of important, and it's important because if you are a foreigner, or if you are of a status that is unlike the status of the rest of the 14th Amendment residents and people, subjects under government, can they get jurisdiction over you by some stretch of the imagination? Well, sure they can. They can get jurisdiction over you even as a free man if you consent, if you give permission, if you fail to object timely, if you allow the service of process to be completed and you appear in court, they can take jurisdiction over you even as a free man. Okay, let's understand that. If a foreigner comes over here and has never been a citizen of the United States, there are jurisdictional implications that he can find himself in if he makes the wrong moves. Same thing can happen to you. Okay, now let's go to the board, and we'll find out here what we should do, or where and at what point these things have a bearing on what we're talking about. Well, here's the summons, and in some states, like in Oregon, when they give you a traffic citation, that is also the complaint. It's a summons and complaint, but in some states, since you get only the summons, the complaint comes later. That is service of process. Okay? We have determined that once this happens, jurisdiction attaches. It attaches right here at the beginning. Now, the next thing that happens is you are to appear at the appointed time in the court. Once you appear in the court, service of process is complete and jurisdiction is locked in. Now, does that mean you shouldn't appear? No, not necessarily. As a matter of fact, it doesn't mean that at all. It only means that as a matter of law and as a matter of procedure, jurisdiction is complete by completed service of process once you appear, because you have been summoned and you appeared. Now, jurisdiction is locked in. Not irreversible jurisdiction. You can still get out of it. Alright? The first thing that happens, now we're going to assume that this is a criminal action, or what's not called a criminal action, which they're not all criminal actions, but we'll just assume criminal action at this point. There are two ways you can go. You can go to an initial appearance, or you can go to an arraignment, and at the arraignment, they will do a couple of things. They'll serve you with a formal complaint, they'll read the complaint in the court, and serve you with a copy, and then they will ask you if you understand the charges, then they'll go ahead and ask you whether you plead guilty or not guilty, or no low contender, and get your plea, and then they're going to move forward in the pretrial phase of the case, heading for trial. From here on out, jurisdiction is locked in. Like I said, when you appear, jurisdiction is locked in. Now, what you have to do is you have to make sure that when you appear in the court, either on paper or in person, or both, that it is an initial appearance and not an arraignment. Now, sometimes these two things are the same. In other words, some initial appearances are also arraignments, but not all arraignments are initial appearances. Okay? An example of that would be somebody in the system comes in, he's summoned. He comes into the court. He tells the judge, I don't want to do anything, I don't want to say anything because I'm incompetent to speak for myself and I need a lawyer. Heaven forbid that he would say that, but if he says that, then it is an initial appearance. We have now an initial appearance, and the judge says, okay, we're going to hold off arraigning you until you've had time to get competent counsel and give your attorney's advice, and then you can come back and we'll arraign you at that time with counsel. See, in that type of situation, what you had there was an initial appearance. It's actually a pre-arraignment appearance. That's the point at which you want to kill the jurisdiction, right there. You don't want to do it at arraignment. You don't want to do it after arraignment. You don't want to do it farther down the line. You want to kill it at the initial appearance, the first thing that happens. Now, you could try to kill it here at the summons stage, but that doesn't work very well. All right, now, later on in the future, I can't say that we shouldn't maybe just refuse to take the summons and kill the jurisdiction right there. But at least for the time being, we're trying to keep a low profile. We're trying to do things as peacefully and as orderly as possible. So it may be necessary for you to take the summons at the on-the-street confrontation, and then between here and here, you must kill the jurisdiction. That's where it has to be done. Now, I say again, can you challenge jurisdiction at any time after arraignment? Absolutely you can. You can challenge jurisdiction at any time. The Supreme Court said that. However, this is where you want to do it. Because once the jurisdiction attaches here, as it says here, it says it continues throughout the entire litigation. Okay? That's extremely important. It's important that you understand how this works. Now, there was a point I wanted to bring up that it'll come back to me, but for now, let's understand what we're saying here and what this means. Now, let me say something else, though. I think I will put one more thing in, and that is this. If you fail to object timely at this point, that's between here and here, at initial appearance, you fail to object timely, and you go forward past arraignment. Now, they may try to, you know, steamroller over you and arraign you by force and whatever, and threaten you with all manner of harm and damages against you. But if you fail to object timely at this point, it is tantamount to consent. You must object timely, or it is consent. Okay. We're going to go through and read a little more out of here, and we're going to form an idea and get a picture for ourselves as to how this jurisdiction works over us. How does it work its attaching and destructive process over the individuals who are actually out of the system. I can look here. There are some of this that I'm not going to read because it's not really on point for what we're talking about. Minimum contacts with the state make it fair exercise of personal jurisdiction. This is important. If you are familiar with the term nexus or the term nexum, then you understand that if you're out of the system, you're not supposed to have any connection to the system. And if there is any connection with the system, it could defeat your jurisdictional bar that you placed against the court. And that's why it says in this book on jurisdiction, it says minimum contacts with the state make it a fair exercise of personal jurisdiction. You're going to have to make sure that you are separate from the system. All right? And it makes some statements here. I'm going to read them. They're important. It says the problem is more complicated in the United States than elsewhere in the common law world because of our federal system. Now, on our other tape, we explained what this federal system is. The federal system that we're involved in is what you want to get out of. That federal system that works with the Federal Reserve notes and the federal government and the federal democracy, that is what you're getting away from. All right? The first facet of the Pennoyer Rule subjects to personal jurisdiction anybody personally served within the state. Okay? But other exceptions have so far been urged unsuccessfully. One of those exceptions is sovereign status. Okay? Ambassadorial immunity. Exterritoriality. Those are exceptions to this. But here in this book, of course, you have to realize this book was written for lawyers. It says, but other exceptions have so far been urged unsuccessfully. All right? Nexus. Due process requirement is that the suit have some reasonable connection with the state in which it is sought. All right, it has to have a reasonable connection. Does the state have sufficient connection with minimum contacts or some other basis? Now, in California, if you're looking for the California Code of Civil Procedure on service of process, you'll find it in CCCP section 410.10. That's where you'll find it. And you start studying in there and you'll find out what this service of process actually is about. It explains, right, believe it or not, in our rules of civil procedure, it goes through and explains what this jurisdiction in personam and jurisdiction in rem is and how it works. It says here that it's so confusing. It says a great number of cases decided each year would render futile any attempt to establish general standards within this framework, even for individual jurisdictions. And then it goes on to say, no wonder the American Law Institute had to state in its principal underlying judicial jurisdiction over persons, which is just a procedural manual for judges and lawyers to use to determine where and when they have jurisdiction, simply through unhelpfully as requiring a person's relationship to the state, which is such as to make the exercise of such jurisdiction reasonable. They have to show See, they have a book here. They have to show that there is a connection between you and the state. They have to show that you own property within their system. I didn't say you couldn't own property. I said own property within their system. They have to show these connections with the state in order to assert the minimum contacts rule and take jurisdiction over you. Okay? Consent. Interesting subject matter. It says the defendant's general appearance, i.e. an appearance lacking expression of a limiting intent, is equivalent to consent. Can you read that again? The defendant's general appearance, i.e. an appearance lacking expression of a limiting intent, is equivalent to consent. All right? Earlier attempts by some states to deny opportunity to challenge territorial jurisdiction though a special, through a special appearance have been abandoned. And that's York in 1890 case. I don't give the whole case site here, but it's in the back of the book. We have those. Here, this is an interesting thing. It says, consent prior to accrual of cause of action. Parties to a contract may agree that any cause of action arising therefrom is the subject to the jurisdiction of a specific court. All right, now what are they saying there? Is to be subject, I should say. It says parties to a contract, so we're talking about a contract here, may agree, that's consent, that any cause of action arising therefrom, any cause of action arising from the contract, is to be subject to the jurisdiction of a specific court. Now what does that mean? Well, if you get a driver's license, if you get a building permit, if you get a marriage license, if you get any of these licenses or permits, they are subject by agreement and contract to the jurisdiction of a specific court. In advance. You see what I'm saying here? In advance. Who has jurisdiction over traffic matters for licensed drivers? Well, the traffic court does. Who has jurisdiction over a marriage license divorce dispute? Well, the divorce court does. These jurisdictions have been agreed to in advance. Now, you can't go in and challenge the jurisdiction of the traffic court if you have a driver's license. And it's disturbing to us here at the church to have people come to us and tell us that they have been advised in the Patriot Movement and they have spent thousands of dollars challenging jurisdiction, fighting issues as if they were as if they had actual standing at law to do so, and then come to find out that these patriots have a driver's license, and that some other patriot charged them money and gave them paperwork that's frivolous and sent them into the traffic court to challenge jurisdiction when it was absolutely frivolous and without merit. We have some problems in the Patriot Movement itself that we need to take care of. There's misinformation being disseminated. There are people in the Patriot Movement that aren't patriots at all. And they're giving out information that's erroneous, it's wrong, it's frivolous, and it's without merit. And it's getting people in trouble, and it's harming people. And some of the time, the courts are correct in stating that there are people out there giving bad legal advice and harming other people. And the courts are correct some of the time. And I'm not saying that you cannot challenge jurisdiction properly and actually prevail based on a legitimate issue. Of course you can. But we have to realize how this jurisdiction works, okay? It's by consent. It's by contract. It's by the things we do. And it says right here, all the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. Ask yourself, what have you done? What have I done to give them jurisdiction? And if I did do something, I had better undo it or do something about it or rescind it or take some sort of action that does away with this jurisdiction. All right, now, with that, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, and we'll get back to this paperwork, but we'll go off on a little tangent, and this has to do with a judge down in California who, I won't use his name, well, for lack of a better name, we'll call him Judge Smedley. This Judge Smedley is down there in the traffic court, and he understands jurisdiction. And he's in the municipal court, the California court, and he understands jurisdiction, and he has a real neat way of handling people who come into the courtroom, and if you'll go down and watch some of these guys, you'll see it too, and you'll start understanding how this jurisdiction works. But Judge Snedley, he has all the people come in, you know, he has the sheriff or bailiff get everybody sitting down there in the audience section, and then this first thing that happens is the sheriff goes around and passes everybody out some sort of a consent form. And he has you sign some sort of consent form there before you even see the judge. And the first thing you want to do is you don't sign anything. If he wants you to sign something, well, you have not consented to sign anything or given up any of your jurisdictional bar against the court. So don't sign anything. Then the judge comes in and he says, come on up here. Why don't you come up here inside the bar? And of course, you may have heard in different, you know, from different patriots that you shouldn't appear in court, that you shouldn't come within the bar of the court, that if you just being in the courthouse gives them jurisdiction, and it, certainly if you are in the courtroom and come within the bar, now you've really had it, now you've really given them jurisdiction, because if they didn't have jurisdiction, then what the heck are you doing there? And the judge may very well ask you that. He said, if we don't have any jurisdiction, then why are you here? And you're going to have an answer for that. But anyway, you're going to find later as we progress into this tape that you can go into the court, you can take up a jurisdictional issue with the court, and not give them the jurisdiction by doing so if you do it correctly. All right? So don't be afraid to go into the court. One thing that you don't want to happen is that you have been issued a warrant for your arrest because you haven't appeared at all. And not give them the jurisdiction by doing so if you do it correctly. All right? So don't be afraid to go into the court. One thing that you don't want to happen is that you have them issue a warrant for your arrest because you haven't appeared at all, haven't put in any paperwork, haven't gone in and made any declaration of your status or anything, and just ignored the proceedings, and here comes the warrant, and they arrest you and throw you in jail. You kind of want to avoid that because when we end up back with that guy that we looked at before with the bars, see, we want to avoid that. All right, now, this Judge Smedley, he says, come on within the bar of the court. Well, first thing that you should do if you have to come in within the bar of the court is you get up to the little gate there that where the bar is and you say, Your Honor, I'm going to approach within the bar of the court under duress, under threat, duress, and coercion for the sole purpose of challenging jurisdiction or asserting a jurisdictional bar. We're also going to talk about the difference between a challenge of jurisdiction and a jurisdictional bar because they are two different things. But don't just walk up within the bar. You better make the statement, I'm coming within the bar of the court for the sole purpose of objecting to, challenging, and putting up a jurisdictional bar to the court. That's why you're there. You're not there for any other purpose. You're not there to demur. You're not there to make any motions. You're not there to ask more time for counsel. You're not there to ask for right sua sponte. You're not there for any of that stuff. You're there to challenge jurisdiction, to put up a jurisdictional bar, to object to the jurisdiction. That's the sole and only purpose why you are there. Okay, but Judge Snedley is smart. You know what he does? Now, it just so happened that we were watching Judge Snedley here about a month ago, and there were other people there, of course. They were being arraigned. And so this is the way Judge Snedley does it. He tricks you into it, and he's very sweet. He's sickening sweet and polite, and it just traps most people. And he says that now, once you get within the bar of the court, and he says, well, you've been charged with such and such, and the complaint's there in front of you, and he says, what would you like to do? And the first guy standing there, he says, well, I'd like to have an attorney. And so he says, oh, okay, fine. Well, are you an indigent individual? And he writes down all the particulars and gives the guy paperwork. And he says, what would you like to do? And the guy says, well, I'd like to have an attorney. All right, well, there's jurisdiction right there. First of all, service of process has been completed, so that jurisdiction is locked in. But the very next phase absolutely ratifies the jurisdiction. The very next thing coming out of your mouth locks that jurisdiction in for good. And as we know, once jurisdiction is acquired, it continues throughout the same litigation. Okay? So the very first thing coming out of your mouth better be the right thing. In this case, it wasn't the right thing because the guy said, I'd like to get an attorney. guy says? He says, well, Mr. B, what do you want to do? And he says, well, he says, I want to plead not guilty, and I want a jury trial. And he says, well, do you have an attorney, Mr. B? And he says, no, I'm going to handle this myself, pro se. And the guy says, you mean you're going to handle the voir dire and the whole trial and everything by yourself? And the guy says, yeah, that's what I want to do. And he asked him, what do they want to do? He says, I want a jury trial. I want to plead not guilty. Well, he just gave the court absolute consent there to try him. Jurisdiction has now been permanently locked in. In the first instance, jurisdiction has been permanently locked in. And you just go right down the line, and he goes, what do you want to do? Well, a friend of mine, who shall go unnamed at this moment, he said, I sure wish the judge had asked me that. Because if he asked me, what do I want to do? He says, I'd like to be down at a coffee shop drinking coffee. I'll see you later. That's what I want to do. And I don't blame it. If the judge asked me, what do I want to do? I'm going to tell him what I want to do. What I really want to do. Be careful of that sneaky, subtle type of approach. And he's very sweet. This judge was so sweet, and it was sickening, like he was really had compassion for the subject. Well, maybe he does have compassion for the subjects under government. But for a patriot to watch that, it's bark time. You have to bring your bark bag with you. Okay? But anyway, he said that then there were some other people, and they were kind of bashful, and they didn't know whether they wanted to come up before the court or not. And he says, come on up. Don't be bashful. Don't be afraid. Just come on up. Like he was protecting his little children. And they came up, and then he did the same thing with them. What do you want to do? And then he went through the same process over again. And I think it's probably one of the slickest ways of locking the jurisdiction in that I have ever seen. Now, what you have to realize is this. The judges, let's go back to the board for a second here. The judges understand and know that this is a critical period from the summons to the initial appearance. They know that if you challenge jurisdiction in here, their jurisdictional basis and authority may be in jeopardy. Therefore, it is within their interest to get you quickly past the initial appearance and moving forward into the case. How do they do that? Well, they get you an attorney. They get you to plead to the charge. They get you to say that you understand the charges. They get you to do all kinds of things, anything to get you past that first point. Now they've got you arguing the merits of the case, arguing in motion hearings, arguing procedural issues like counsel and suppress the evidence and all those kinds of things, venue and all that kind of stuff, you see. Once they get you arguing that, it's too late. You blew it. It's too late. You have got to do what you're going to do between summons and initial appearance. And if you fail to do so, it is too late. For all intents and purposes, you have blown it. Okay? Don't make any motions before the court. All right. Now, we want to establish something else before we go on. That is challenging jurisdiction a privilege? Is it a grant? Or is it a right? Okay, let's get this thing nailed down. Challenging jurisdiction is a right. You have a right to challenge jurisdiction. They know it. We here at the church know it. I have no idea who else in the Patriot Movement knows it. But you can just realize right now it is not something that they grant to you. You have the right to challenge jurisdiction. The absolute right. Don't let them run roughshod over you thinking, and you sitting there thinking that you can't challenge the jurisdiction. You're sitting there going, well, I challenged jurisdiction, and the judge just took the paperwork and he just threw it over there, and then he said, how do you plead? And you're sitting there going, I thought I put in a jurisdictional challenge. Maybe that was some other guy and it wasn't me. I don't know. Well, then you're going to have to be the belligerent claimant in person and say, wait a minute, Your Honor. I challenge jurisdiction. Are we going to address this issue, Your Honor? Did you read the papers? Did you even read the papers? One of the problems we have in the Patriot Movement is that we have some patriots who must evidently have written books before they became patriots because their pleadings are this thick. And they hand it into the court. And then the judge, all those pleadings, you were talking about 2 months of work that you put in to put those pleadings in, and the judge says, oh, I see you challenge jurisdiction here. That's real nice. That's denied. And the problem is he never read the paperwork. And you'll find that some of the stupid things you see happen in court have got to be the result of a judge and a lawyer that didn't read the paperwork. And you know, it's kind of interesting when you bring that up, when you say, Your Honor, have you read the paperwork? Have you read the file? Do you know what's in the file? And the judge, he only can go two ways on that. Now, this is kind of interesting, because if you ask the judge that, and the judge says, well, no, I haven't read the file. I don't really know what's in your jurisdictional challenge. Well, that's the wrong thing for him to say, because then you can say, you didn't read the file? You don't know this legal paper here, this jurisdictional challenge? You didn't read that? Oh, well, heck, Your Honor, we're going to have to do something about that. This is going to have to be a complaint to the Judicial Fitness Board of your state. And all kinds of things can happen as a result of him not reading the paperwork. Now, let's say that it goes the other way, and you say, well, Your Honor, did you read the file? Do you know what's in there? Do you know all my challenges and all my issues that were brought up? There's absolutely, I read the file. I know all the issues that you have brought up here, and it's denied. Okay, well, let's don't talk about whether he denied or didn't deny. That's, at this point in time, that's not the major issue. The major issue here is he has now admitted that he read the entire issue. He better be right, because if he is not, and if he rules without jurisdiction, he has committed an offense. He has committed a damage upon you that you can redress. Okay? You might as well get these admissions and confessions out of him if you get the opportunity to do so, because once he says he's read the whole file, he has to rule properly, or he is personally liable. Okay? So ask him these types of questions, and that's important that you do that. Now, from here on forward, let's go back here to, we'll go back and read some more out of this jurisdiction booklet. We want to get this to the point where there's no doubt anymore in your mind of where we are with this jurisdiction. Okay? Forum benefits and activities, long-arm statutes. Non-resident motorists. Jurisdiction has long been assumed over non-resident motorists who have caused an accident in the forum state. The forum state is just the state that the court that's hearing the case is in. Such statutory jurisdiction was originally based upon the presumption of the defendant's implied consent. All right? If you don't say anything, if you don't object, the consent is implied. Furthermore, there is the problem of being classified as a resident. Now, we know the pitfalls of being called a driver or an operator. These words have legal significance within the system. So don't call yourself a driver, okay? A resident. Should you call yourself a resident? A state which affords privileges and affords protection to a person and his property by virtue of his domicile may also exact reciprocal duties. This is Milliken. It's a U.S. case, 1940. Okay, now, we have to realize a couple of things are maxims of law, all right? Some of these maxims of law say, he who takes the risk also carries the responsibility, and also, he who takes the risk carries the responsibility. You have to be responsible for your own actions. Okay? You put that responsibility off and risk off on somebody else, and you give him the power and the responsibility to decide things for you. Alright? So if you are a resident, sometimes I don't even know which words to use anymore, but let's say you're an inhabitant of a state, at that point you must be sure that you stand on your own. You stand on your own. The state does not protect you. The state does not take responsibility for you. You take the responsibility for your own actions. It's the opposite of limited liability. Okay? Resident. Citizenship in a state of the union is synonymous with domicile. Here again, if you live in a state, if you have a house in a state, they are going to consider you, number one, a resident of the state. Number two, they're going to consider you a citizen of the state. And unfortunately for you, In this case, when they mean citizen of the state, they also mean subject of the state. Okay, subject. Not sovereign individual, but subject of the state. You are going to have to object to this. You are going to have to say, I am not a citizen of the state of Oregon, or whatever state you're in, and I am not a resident of the state of Oregon. Okay? All right, let me skip over here. In Penoyer versus Neff, U.S. 1878 case, the Supreme Court has said that the state could exercise jurisdiction over non-residents making contracts enforceable within the state. All right, so if you're a resident and they classify you as a resident, they have jurisdiction over you, the state does. If you're a non-resident, okay, but you have contracts, you're making contracts enforceable within that state, then you are also under their jurisdiction. If you are a landowner within their system, when I say within their system, I don't mean that you own the land at law in Herodian. Be simple. I mean that you own the land in their system. In other words, one of those so-called deeds that says right on the deed, you must check with your local building department and this and that, and you're on the tax rolls and all these other ties that you're involved in. If you have land in the system, that can be the basis for jurisdiction. And the reason for that is because there's an in rem attachment. See, if they can't find you, it doesn't matter because they have your property. And they can take the judgment against your property, even though you're not there. So that can be the basis of jurisdiction. Now, of course, the question comes up, if you own an allodium freehold estate, is that property in the state of their system? Well, the answer to that is no, it's not. All right, skip over here. Jurisdiction in rem. Now, jurisdiction in personam is jurisdiction over the person. Jurisdiction in rem is jurisdiction over the thing or subject matter. The res. A state has authority to adjudicate claims of interest in property situated within the state. Now, that's true. These are general statements, but there are exceptions to the rule. Okay? They're talking about from the standpoint of what is the perspective we're talking about. We are talking about within the system. That's what this book was written for. We have to read between the lines and understand how this applies to what we're doing. Under the Penoyer rule, in rem jurisdiction was justified on the ground that the state necessarily had power over all things within its borders. It says necessarily had power. The Penoyer rule was written in 1878. The 14th Amendment came in 1868. Okay? You will find that when they use case citations, they generally use case citations from 1868 forward. Because all those case citations relate to how their system works, not to how substantive at-law, common law rights used to work. Okay? So does the Penoyer rule apply to you? Well, if you allow it to apply to you, if you acquiesce to the jurisdiction, it can apply to you. Under the modern minimum contacts concept, in rem jurisdiction is justified on the ground that the presence of the property is itself an affiliating circumstance that makes the exercise of jurisdictions reasonable. Okay, now, you may find that this is somewhat redundant as I go through and explain this, but you'll see why the redundance is necessary. Under the modern minimum contacts concept, here we go again, nexus, minimum contacts. What are your contacts with the state? You better not have any contacts with the state, but if they do, it is the basis of jurisdiction. In rem jurisdiction is justified on the ground that the presence of property is itself an affiliating circumstance that makes the exercise of jurisdiction reasonable. Notice they didn't say it makes the jurisdiction exercise of jurisdiction absolute. It says reasonable. Well, sure, it's reasonable if you're in the system, if you have a birth certificate, if you own property in the system, and the property is within their state, and you have contact with the state, you're darn right it's reasonable. That's what they're talking about here. All right. Okay, it talked here about constructive service of process. We really don't want to get into that right now. All right, now, this is an interesting part of this. It says, standing to be sued, sovereigns, United States. Now, we have to understand that they are claiming the United States is sovereign, and then they're claiming that the state is sovereign. Of course, we know that the 14th Amendment, for all intents and purposes, did away with state sovereignty and any semblance thereof. Certain persons have always enjoyed immunity from the court's jurisdiction, okay? Thus, the United States may not be sued without its consent. Now, we have to realize that sovereigns can't be sued without their consent, all right? And in this case, the United States is claiming to be sovereign. Purportedly because there can be no right against the authority that makes the law on which the right depends. And the case is Kawananakoa versus Polly Blank. It's a 1907 case. It's a Supreme Court case. But there are many inroads into this rule. Okay? Now, I can tell you here, there are ways around that. But that's not going to be the basic subject matter of this. Foreign sovereigns. Such plaintiffs will be denied immunity with regard to their commercial operations and will be prevented from invoking our law but resisting a claim against it, which fairly would curtail its recovery. Now, what we're talking about here, if you have a foreign sovereign who comes within the boundaries of the United States and has commercial contacts with the United States, that's the key, commercial contacts. Do you have commercial contacts with the United States? Or with anything within the commercial system of this country? If you do, you cannot go into court and claim immunity and say that you will not give consent to be sued. And believe it or not, a traffic ticket, as we will find out here in a little bit, is a suit. It isn't a criminal action, it's a suit. All right? The various types of diplomatic immunity are outside the scope of this book, since they pertain to public international law, such as church sovereignty. I wrote that in here. Now, church sovereignty is a subject of another tape, but if you are interested in the religious freedom aspect of this subject, or you're interested in a church entity that is not a creation of the state and is a sovereign entity, then you need to get this other tape. It's called church sovereignty. Diplomatic immunity, it says, are outside the scope of this book since they pertain to public international law. And you'll find out that sovereignty and the issues that we are involved in, if they violate these issues, that they have violated international law. It's a breach of international law. That's what it is. Voluntary appearance. This is interesting. Anyone who voluntarily appears, presents his case, and is fully heard is thereafter concluded by the judgment of the tribunal to which he has submitted his cause. Because voluntary appearance. All right? 1931 case. The last principle preclusion from attack by participation has been held applicable in divorce judgments even though the third parties are heard, blah, blah, blah. Not important, but it has to do with taking issue. It says the last principle preclusion from attack by participation. All right. Now, first of all, we talked about voluntary appearance. All right, so we appear voluntarily. If you appear generally and voluntarily and move past the initial appearance stage, jurisdiction's attached, and now you've submitted yourself to the jurisdiction of the court. Now it says the last principle, preclusion, is a preclusion from attack by the principle of participation. What do they mean, participation? Well, you can't go in there, you can't take issue. You can't go in there and argue that the evidence should be suppressed because the police officer used erroneous, unconstitutional methods. You can't go in there and argue let me use a good example here. Counsel can become, if it's allowed to go too far, counsel can become that type of an issue where you're participating. Motions, all those kinds of things. You're actually participating in the proceedings themselves. Now, you want to be careful of that. Do not take issue. Do not take issue here. You must not take issue because You must not take issue, because if you do, then the jurisdiction will lock in. All right? Now, they have tricks and ways to get you into that. One of the ways, and I'm going to use it as an example, is the IRS. The IRS has a nasty habit, which they do quite frequently, is they will look at your file, you know, they'll look at what they figure you owe, and they'll just jack it up about 50 times and say, well, you owe us, and they'll say, hey, you owe us $200,000. And if you can appeal this thing, you send in a 90-day letter, and say, you can appeal this thing and petition the tax court and try to get this straightened out. And of course, you come totally unglued and you say, well, I don't owe $200,000. And you get up there and you say, well, I don't owe $200,000. I only owe $2,000. What have you just done? You've just taken issue with the amount you owe. The issue isn't how much do you owe. The issue is, do they have jurisdiction to even ask you anything or do anything? That's the issue. Don't let them trick you, get you emotionally involved so that they can get you to arguing as to how much you owe. Or they can get you arguing whether you ran the stop sign or not. Or they can get you arguing as to whether or not you were actually even driving. You know, that's always a good one where they get you in there and they say, I wasn't driving, my wife was driving. You see, now we're arguing merits of what's happening out there. That's not the issue. Do not let them get you into anything but a jurisdictional challenge, bar, objection. That's it. It doesn't go beyond that. All right. International jurisdiction, domestic standards, but it applies to our courts. It says, all courts reserve to themselves the right to apply their own standards of jurisdiction. So you have to be careful about that. Each place is different. Each one makes its own determination of what the standard of jurisdiction is. Criminal jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction. The common law considers crimes as altogether local and cognizable and punishable exclusively in the country where they were committed. All right, this comes from Story, Conflict of Laws, 1834. Okay. This rests, it says, this principle rests on the ancient guarantee that every defendant must be tried by a jury of the county or vicinage in which the crime was committed. All right? That's for the common law. That's for offenses at common law. Now, we have to understand the different jurisdictions that we're involved in, okay? And that's, we're going to get into a little bit about identifying the nature of the jurisdiction when you're brought into court, because that is one way that you can upset the court and bring the proceedings to a halt. But for right now, we have to understand a couple of things about common law and a couple of things about jurisdiction of the common law and jurisdiction of the system we're involved in right now, and how that works. It says right here, this is a territorial jurisdiction, and they're talking more or less about international relations, okay? International meaning that the world at large accepts certain common law rules. It says, rests on the ancient guarantee that every defendant must be tried by a jury of the county or the vicinage in which the crime was committed, okay? So in other words, we are saying here that it is an ancient guarantee, an ancient common law guarantee, that you will be tried by a jury for a crime, by a jury. Now what does that mean? Does that mean that if you go into the traffic court because you've been sued with a ticket for some violation of a contract, does that mean that you're going to get a trial by jury because it's an ancient guarantee? Are we dealing with the common law? Does the common law have anything to do with the traffic court? Absolutely not. When we're talking about these common law offenses, we're talking about real offenses at common law. We're talking about murder, rape, theft, burglary, those types of things. Those are common law offenses. These other things that we're talking about have nothing to do with it. So, not to say that wherever you see a jury, you find common law. I'm not saying that. The common law, wherever there is common law, there is a jury. But wherever there's a jury, there isn't necessarily common law. Okay? Goes on to say here on criminal jurisdiction, moreover, a citizen of the United States, by virtue of the obligations of such citizenship, well, that brings up an interesting thing. What kind of obligations does being a citizen of the United States have? And here, since this book is of recent origin, we would assume that they're talking about a 14th Amendment citizen. It says, by virtue of the obligations of such citizenship, may, if a statute so prescribes, constitutionally be prosecuted in this country for any crime against it committed abroad. Okay? That has nothing to do with anything except for that first part that we were talking about. A foreign court's jurisdiction over its own citizens will be recognized though the alleged crime was committed in this country, even if the defendant was also a citizen of the United States. This could apply very easily when you're under the Almighty's jurisdiction. You see, it becomes a subject of international law when you become separate from the system under a different jurisdiction. Prosecution for treasonable acts committed abroad is founded on U.S. Constitution, Article 3, Section 3, and with regard to aliens owing allegiance to the United States. Do you owe any allegiance to the United States? It's important questions that have to be answered. What is the entity that we're talking about when we say United States? Are we talking about the federal democracy? Is that what we owe an allegiance to? Have to be clear on those issues. Personal jurisdiction in general. In general, criminal jurisdiction is predicated on the defendant's presence within the state. That jurisdiction is not impaired by the fact that the presence was unlawfully obtained, okay? So in other words, when we're talking criminal jurisdiction, real criminal jurisdiction, not a driving traffic ticket, I'm talking about a real crime, then personal jurisdiction can be obtained by your presence in the state. All right? Needless to say, you don't want to commit any real criminal acts. All right, I think we've pretty much covered all we need to cover out of this. What we're going to do now, I gave you some cases in our first segment that related to jurisdiction, and I'm going to give you the case sites at this time. And let's see, one case I'm going to give you is the Baldwin case, which has to do with voluntary appearance, where we spoke about voluntary appearance. And the case site on that is Baldwin versus Iowa State Traveling Men's Association. That's 283 U.S. 522, 51 Supreme Court 517, 75 Lawyers Edition 1244, 1931 case. Okay, the next case is Kiwanis Nakoa versus Polly Blank, which has to do with sovereignty. And the site on that is 205 U.S. 349, 27 Supreme Court 526, 51 Lawyers Edition, 834, it's a 1907 case, and this is at page 90. All right, the next case is a Michigan Trust Company versus Ferry, which that case has to do with the fact that jurisdiction, once it attaches, continues throughout the whole litigation. That's Michigan Trust Company versus Ferry, 228 U.S. 346, 33 Supreme Court 550, 57 Lawyers Edition, 867. It's a 1913 case, and it's at page 22. The next case is Pennoyer versus Neff, which has to do with service of process, getting personal jurisdiction by service of process. That's 95 U.S. 714, 24 Lawyers Edition, 565. It's an 1877 case. It says here 1877, however, in another place in the book it says 1878, so it's very close together, those 2 years. And then it says, comma 25, comma 53. So it'd be at those pages where it talks about that. All right, those are the case sites. We're now going to talk about the nature of the jurisdiction being asserted against you. Now, if we can go back to, this is the one we want right here. It
if we go to the board here and we look at this summons and complaint, and then we look at the initial appearance, what some of the Patriots have been doing and the strategy being used is that they determine at the initial appearance and bring up the issue of what is the jurisdiction being asserted against me. Now, you have to understand that if the judge asks you, do you understand the charges, and you say, yes, I understand the charges, then you are literally saying that you understand the nature of the jurisdiction that's being brought against you, you understand all the implications of that jurisdiction, and you waive any objection to the jurisdiction and then move forward with a complete understanding of what that jurisdiction is. Therefore, it's the approach of some of the Patriots that they will go in and demand of the court that the court identify the type of jurisdiction and the nature of the jurisdiction being brought against them, because it is their position that they cannot defend against a jurisdiction that they do, if they don't know what it is. That's their position. And some of the jurisdictions that it could be that we're talking about is it civil? Is it criminal? Is it at law? Is it equity? Is it administrative? Is it admiralty? Is it maritime? Is it corporate policy? Is it a jurisdiction brought on under martial law, under the emergency powers, under executive orders issued by the president? What kind of jurisdiction is it? Now, the way that I understand it here at the church, they have had some moderate success with that kind of an approach, even to the point that the case is dismissed or it dies on the vine, because they don't want to identify, or they can't identify, the jurisdiction that they're bringing against you. But one thing is certain, and that is, if you say that you understand the charges, you are giving your approval to the jurisdiction and stating that you fully understand the type of jurisdiction being brought against you, and that you are now ready to move forward with the knowledge of that jurisdiction and go to trial. That's what you're saying. So you don't understand the charges. That's what we're getting at. Now, it is our position here that the jurisdiction being asserted against us is a combination of these other jurisdictions. It's not a pure jurisdiction. It's not pure admiralty. It's not pure maritime. It's not pure administrative. It's a combination. It's a mutation jurisdiction. But if you look at it from the perspective that if they have no jurisdiction over you and you are able to assert that and able to defeat the assertion or the assumption of their jurisdiction over you, then what does it matter what the jurisdiction is? If there's no jurisdiction, I don't care what it is. That's one way of looking at it, and that's pretty much the way we look at it here. Now, it's interesting to know whether we're dealing with administrative equity that has overtones of admiralty and overtones of equity and civil criminal. Now, I'll say, the reason I say civil criminal, I'll get into that in a minute, but some of these things that they call criminal aren't criminal at all. It's interesting to know all that, but we should be aware that if they don't have any jurisdiction over you, it does not matter what the jurisdiction is, as long as it has no power over you. And that's where we're going with this civil criminal. Now, we're going to use a different visual aid here, which has to do with the civil and criminal nature of charges being brought against you. Okay. You have an action that's commenced. The action is either going to be civil, or it's going to be criminal, or it's going to be quasi-criminal. In other words, it's going to be a civil action with a criminal penalty. All right, now you may ask, well, how can that be? I'll explain that. Your true and pure civil action is a civil action brought by a sovereign inhabitant against a sovereign inhabitant for an actual damage at law. That's a true civil action, okay? A true criminal action is done this way. It'll either be commenced in one of two ways. There'll either be a document brought into court, which is called an accusatory instrument. This accusatory instrument is brought before the people in the form of a grand jury, and they will issue a true bill or no true bill. If they issue a true bill, there'll be an indictment. The indictment is then forwarded to the judge for the issuance of a warrant. The warrant is then forwarded to the sheriff for the arrest to take place. They go out and arrest the individual. He's put in jail. He's brought before the judge supposed to be within a certain amount of time, that has to be quick, is brought before the judge, and they have a bail hearing to determine whether or not the man has the right to bail. They then have him post bail, and he is then released on bail. That is a true criminal proceeding. Now, it doesn't have to start with the accusatory instrument. It can start with the arrest first. In other words, you start with an arrest, the man is put in jail, the accusatory instrument is typed up, it's brought before the grand jury issues an indictment, and the warrant, the warrant is not part of it at that point because he's already been arrested. So it can start with an arrest, then go to indictment, then go to the bail hearing. Okay? Those are the two ways that a criminal action is commenced. Okay, then we go down here to what we call quasi-criminal, which is a civil action with a criminal penalty. All right? Now, an example of that, now we might say, well, how is it that you can have a civil action with a criminal penalty? Well, you can. The example we use, for lack of a better example, we use IBM. No reflection on IBM whatsoever, but IBM Corporation Policy. It's just a corporate policy. All right, now let me turn this over, and we'll take a look at what we're talking about. Let's say that an individual goes to IBM Corporation, and they go to get a job there at IBM Corporation, and IBM Corporation tells them, okay, we will give you a position within our system. I should write that down. This is more than just a job. This is an actual system. It's a system of doing things. All right? We have this system, and within this corporate system, they have you sign up on their corporate policy. They have you sign a contract. They have you make an agreement. And when you sign up with this corporation, you agree that if you violate the corporate policy of this corporation, that it will be a contract violation, and you give implied consent to be incarcerated in the corporate jail. All right? Now, the question is this. Can you be put in jail? In other words, can there be a criminal penalty on a civil violation? The answer is yes, there can be, especially in the system that we're involved in. So, what we're saying here is it possible to end up in jail without an indictment, without all of the other criminal procedural things that we're used to and that we believe we're guaranteed? Can we be put in jail without due process of law under constitutional protections? Can we be put in jail under these circumstances? And the answer again is yes. Now, where do constitutional rights come into play? Well, the answer is they don't very much come into play in the arena where they have corporate rules. And that corporate rule that I just read you, the one where the state claiming that it owns all the wildlife in the state, and the fact is, of course, they don't own all the wildlife. If we go to the scriptures, it says, all the world is mine, saith the Lord. So he owns all wildlife, all property, all substance. The state does not own it. Okay? First thing you do, you go down to the district attorney's office and you get discovery as a pro se. I did that and I acquired three pieces of paper. One of them is the complaint, and it was before it was signed. It was just a blank complaint against me, so I saw it before I even went to court for any initial appearance or anything. I knew what they were going to bring against me. The district attorney's intake processing sheet and the police report. And I can tell you that the police report is just filled with lies. But anyway, such as it is, that's what I got. You too should go down to the district attorney's office and gain discovery for yourself. And don't take no for an answer. You go down there and you tell them that you are representing yourself and that this is a so-called criminal action and you want discovery. And you can get that, all right? The next thing that you do, oh, also, you better be ready to, when you go to court, you better be ready to have the confrontation of possibly being booked into the jail and being released somehow
And that is, of course, what happened in my case, and we're going to talk about that. But before that, before the actual initial appearance occurs, which we spoke of earlier, you need to file some papers in that courthouse. All right? Now, what I did is, and you're going to need some of this stuff also, what I did is I took the complaint that they served on me on, at the initial appearance, and I stamped jurisdiction challenged on it. Now, I've got a stamp here that says jurisdiction challenged. Let's go to the board just briefly and check out some of the types of stamps that you might want to get for yourself so that you can use them. All right, we have here a stamp void. We have a stamp that says jurisdiction challenged, which is the one that I just used or spoke of. We have a stamp that says exhibit number. We have a stamp that says certified, a true copy by. You initial it and date it. And we also have a stamp, which is a very important stamp, and it says filed with the county sheriff by, you check a box, certified mail or hand delivery, and it's initialed and dated. This is very important because the sheriff is the common law officer of the county, and he is the only officer that the people get to vote for. You don't get to vote for the state police. You don't get to vote for the city police. You literally don't get to vote for any IRS agents or U.S. Marshals or anything like that. The sheriff is the only one that you can vote for. And we serve all paperwork that is also served on the court. In any case that we're involved in or whatever, goes directly to the sheriff, and we use this stamp to do so. And I urge you to do the same thing. I urge you to put pressure on your sheriff so that you can, you have to go, whether he does it or not is immaterial at this point. You go in there and you go tell him you're the common law officer of this county. I want common law protection and you are to protect me. And you serve all the papers on him that you serve on the court. So everything that we're talking about here also went to the sheriff. Okay? What we did is we put together a pleading. And this pleading is entitled this way. Of course, it says that now this paperwork here that I'm talking about is going to be included in the paperwork packet that accompanies this tape. We're going to slowly but surely go through what was done here. It says, in the District Court of the State of Oregon for the County of Klamath, the State of Oregon et al. Against Mike Benjamins Jr., the accused. Now, we have a case number, then we have a caption in the spot where you give what type of pleading it is. Right above it, we put special appearance under threat, duress, and coercion for the sole purpose of challenging the court's jurisdiction in personam and in rem. Now, remember, you're not just challenging the in rem jurisdiction, and you're not just challenging the in personam jurisdiction. You're challenging the in rem and in personam jurisdiction. Okay? Now, this is entitled Notice and Demand to Quash the Summons and Complaint for Lack of Jurisdiction. This is interesting. You see, I'll have to go back to my previous card here so that we can look at this again. This is interesting because from the summons on forward to the initial appearance, they want to, the only way that you can properly challenge the jurisdiction and put up a jurisdictional bar is to kill the jurisdiction at the initial appearance stage. Now, we said that. It is in their interest to get you past the initial appearance stage and moving forward in the case. You see? That's why this thing is entitled Notice and Demand to Quash the Summons and Complaint. Here's the summons. In Oregon, the summons and complaint is the same document. And then at the arraignment, they also serve you with an additional formal complaint. So your notice and demand is to quash the summons and complaint for lack of jurisdiction. If you fail to do this, then service of process has been issued, jurisdiction attaches, service of process is completed, and it's locked in. And as soon as you start moving past this initial stage, the jurisdiction is locked in. You must kill it at this point. All right? Now, I'm going to go through and read parts of this. And of course, it's going to be different from case to case, depending on the circumstances that you're talking about. But in this case, it had to do with the circumstances in my confrontation. It says, comes now the accused, Michael Benjamins Jr., in propria persona,
without the assistance of unfettered counsel of choice, by special appearance under threat, duress, and coercion, for the sole purpose of challenging the jurisdiction in personam and in rem, and specially files this notice and demand to quash the summons and complaints with an S in parentheses, based upon the following. Number one, insufficiency of service of process by the plaintiff. Okay? Number two, jurisdictionally defective service of process. Number three, lack of jurisdiction over the accused both in personam and in rem based upon the lawful status of said accused. Okay? Number four, upon the various solemn statements and exhibits which are attached hereto and by this reference made a part hereof. There's some interesting things in here which actually aren't the key subjects of this tape, but if you want to know more about these other subjects, you need to get some of the other tapes that we have. One of them is entitled The Sovereignty of the Church, because we do talk about that somewhat in this pleading. The plaintiffs have failed to properly serve the summons and complaint, in that said summons was and complaint was not served upon the person of the accused herein. Refer to ORCP Rule 7. Now, Rule 7 is a procedural civil rules having to do with how a summons has to be served, and the related procedural service of process rules for criminal and quasi-criminal actions. The summons and complaint, which were not served upon the person of the accused, was served upon the wrong person on a lawful church sanctuary. Okay? Remnant Church, Allodium Freehold Estate at Law, where the summons and complaint was without jurisdiction. Now, we're attacking their right to serve a summons and complaint on a Lodium property, which is also a church sanctuary. And that's the issue that's being brought up. Even if the summons and complaint had been served personally upon the accused, which is not the case here, this raises the issue of lack of jurisdiction to pursue service of process upon a lawfully declared sanctuary of a sovereign church entity. Sovereign and ambassadorial immunity from legal process is asserted under the dominion and jurisdiction of Yahweh the Father and Yahshua the Son. The lawful status of the accused is a major issue in this case. Now, it's not the only issue, it's a major issue. I'd like to say, too, that for them to violate the church sanctuary, which is sovereign ground, is a violation of international law. It is not, per se, a violation of rights that flow from the First Amendment of the Constitution. The church sovereignty issue, the church does not derive its power from the First Amendment of the Constitution. It does, in fact, derive its power from international law and not from the First Amendment. So don't make that mistake. Like I say, it's not the subject of this tape. If you want that information, it's on another tape. The lawful status of the accused is a major issue in this case. The accused is not a citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment is the amendment which created subjects under government. And you should be aware of that, so you want nothing to do with the 14th Amendment. And therefore, he is not regulated in commerce through Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the United States. The challenge of jurisdiction as entered by the accused as a special appearance on the 29th day of September 1986 is totally realleged herein, as if it were fully set forth herein, and by this reference is made a part hereof. Now, the accused has been, and still is, under threat, duress, and coercion since the inception of this case. All appearances have been special appearances for the sole purpose of challenging the jurisdiction in personam and in rem. This accused has not, now listen to this is very important. This accused has not expressly consented to the exercise of personal jurisdiction over him. Refer to ORCP Rule 4A5 and other applicable sections of ORCP Rule 4. Okay? In addition, this accused is isolated from the attachment of in rem jurisdiction both by his lawful status and by the insufficiency of service of summons and process. Refer to ORCP Rule 5 and the previous challenge of jurisdiction mentioned. Now, in this case, there were two challenges entered. Refer also to ORCP Rule 6 for the following. The accused has not waived the jurisdictional defects in this case, and the accused is within his rights to specially enter the court for the sole purpose, as declared, of challenging the alleged jurisdiction, assumed alleged jurisdiction, by the way. All right? No amount of threat, duress, or coercion under the cloak and color of law creates irreversible assumptions of jurisdiction. Refer also to ORCP Rule 21G. Now, we spoke about Rule 21G. The accused does not waive the jurisdictional defects in this case. Remember and be sure that you do not inadvertently waive your jurisdictional defects that exist in the case. Because that is what they're going to try to... Remember Judge Smedley? He says, what do you want to do? Well, I want to go to trial. Oh, you do? Okay, well, we're going to do that. What do you want to do? Do you want a hearing on this jurisdiction? Well, we're going to get into that in a little bit, but the fact is, no, you don't want a hearing on jurisdiction. There's nothing to argue about, okay? We're going to get into that in a little while. We're jumping ahead of ourselves here. Now, the accused shall cite in a limited manner the following case law in support of the notice and demand to quash the summons and complaint. Now, the cases that you should cite and could cite, but it's not limited to this, are as follows. If a court has no jurisdiction of a person, he may ignore the proceedings and will not be adversely affected by the void judgment against him. That was Los Angeles versus Morgan. We spoke about it earlier. Next case cited here, a special appearance may be made for the sole purpose of objecting to the lack of jurisdiction of the court over the person without submitting to such jurisdiction. That's Davenport versus Superior Court. Objection of lack of jurisdiction of the person is often raised by a formal motion to quash summons. Same case, Davenport. Then we went to Josephson versus Superior Court about the affidavits and that it doesn't expand the grounds of the jurisdictional challenge motion. Then we quoted the case of Higgins versus Levine, 415 U.S. 533. It says, once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be proven. Okay? What they don't tell you here in this case, it says once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be proven. The problem with it is that it tells you just enough to get you in trouble. Yes, you can challenge jurisdiction at any time, but you have to do it at the beginning. What it really should say, once jurisdiction is properly challenged, it must be proven. The word properly is a key thing in that. No sanction can be imposed absent proof of jurisdiction. Standard versus Owen, 74 Supreme Court, 768. Where the jurisdiction is not squarely challenged, that subject matter is presumed to exist. Burks versus Lasker, 441 U.S. 471. Where the subject matter is not within the jurisdiction, the court may dismiss on its own motion. They don't have to have a motion from you. They can dismiss on their own motion. Cormley versus McIntosh and Robertson versus State. Okay? The privilege to be regulated in commerce is voluntary. See, when you're in the system, you're regulated in a commercial enterprise, like IBM Corporation. Pursuant to the trustees, the cases, the trustees of Dartmouth College versus Woodward, 17 U.S., 4 Wheaton, 518, 4 Lawyers Edition, 629, it's an 1819 case. Okay? We'll go on with this, the paperwork we have here. Go to this particular paperwork here. It says the accused. The accused is not a citizen of the state of Oregon, nor a citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment. Nor is the accused a resident in the legal sense of the classification of the word. Rather, the accused is a lawful inhabitant of the Republic of America. Therefore, he is a non-resident, and the case quoted here is N. Ray Bryan versus Bryan. It's an Oregon case. The accused occupies the same geographical area as the 14th Amendment residents of the state of Oregon. However, in every lawful respect, the accused is separate. Now, if you go to the Bible, you'll find that separate and the word holy are synonymous with each other. Although that also is a subject of another tape. No long-arm statute may attach in the face of the jurisdictional challenge. North Pacific Steamship versus Jurisco. Nexum, N-E-X-U-M, is a key element in order for there to be jurisdictional ground to proceed. The case is C period, O period, W period, Incorporated versus the Motor Vehicles Division. It's an Oregon case. And there are other cases, White Stag versus Windsurfing Incorporated, Gardner versus Donovan. These are all in the paperwork that will accompany the tape. In this case, the plaintiff must show a substantial continuing nexus in order to establish jurisdictional foundation. You remember the minimum contacts rules that we read out of this book here, jurisdiction? Minimum contacts, and that is St. X. Rel. Swear versus Crookham. It's also an Oregon case. I'll read it again. In this case, the plaintiff must show a substantial continuing nexus in order to establish jurisdictional foundation. Okay? Now, there are some other things that we did in this case. I'm not going to go into the details of them at this point, but they're kind of interesting, and that is that we brought up some case law in Oregon that shows that the county court is no longer a constitutional court. And that's Thiel versus Jackson County, 177 Oregon 210. It's F-E-H-L, Thiel versus Jackson County. And also stated in the same case, it says that they abolished and remade the county court and actually changed it from a court to an administrative unit, and this happened in 1910. Now, you will have to research your state reporter to see whether or not in 1910 they amended your state constitution and changed the court to an administrative unit. They did do it in Oregon. And I would venture to say they probably did it all over in other places in the United States. It goes, I'll read part of this to you because it's kind of interesting. It says, hence, under Section 1 of Article 7 as amended in 1910, the Supreme Court is the only court created by the Constitution itself. All other courts are to be created by legislative act. In truth, but subject to certain qualifications unnecessary to mention, the legislature is empowered to change at any time the entire judicial system of this state. And the quote they gave there is State X. Rel. Madden versus Crawford, 207 Oregon 76, at page 82 to 83. Okay? Now I close this pleading with, the accused herein is not subject to the in personam and in rem jurisdiction being forcibly asserted, and it is unlikely that this court can even render or afford a remedy at law for an inhabitant of the Republic of America. Wherefore, this accused files this notice and demand to have the summons and complaints quashed for lack of jurisdiction. This filing may also be construed as an action to abate the proceedings against this accused. Dated this 6th day of October 1986, respectfully submitted, Mike Benjamins, Jr., the accused. Okay, we did put a solemn statement in support of notice and demand to quash the summons and complaint. A solemn statement is what we use in place of an affidavit. And we don't swear because, as we know, you're not to swear according to the scripture. So we have an alternative way of doing that. We use a solemn statement to support the pleading that we have put in there. All right? We put as exhibits to this pleading, we put some paperwork showing what things that we have done to change our status. We put that on there. And of course, the complaint itself. Now, I'll show you this complaint. The complaint itself looks like this, and I took my jurisdiction challenge stamp, and with this stamp, I just took it and took the complaint that they gave me, and I just stamped five times on their jurisdiction challenge. I put it on the screen and sent it back to them. So, you can't say that everything that you do when you're doing this isn't fun, because some of it's fun. We have a declaration of sanctuary in this case. We won't. Some of this is going to be in the paperwork packet, some of it isn't, but whatever we absolutely feel necessary for you to go in and challenge jurisdiction or assert a jurisdictional bar, we will include in the paperwork packet, because it's very important that you are able to do this using the procedures that we're talking about here today. Okay? And it ended up being quite lengthy. I've got a rescission paperwork here. which shows what my status is. And it was all put together on the same document, and in it went. And it's a quite thick document. This was filed the 6th of October of this year, and to this date, we have not heard anything yet to show of what's happening on this. But anyway, I'll explain here what we've got. We have got a face sheet that I sent to the sheriff along with the paperwork that he got. And I'll read you what it says on here. It says, State of Oregon versus Michael Benjamin, Jr., case number 86-2328-MD, meaning misdemeanor, district court case. Issue, challenge of jurisdiction against aggression by the State of Oregon. Purpose of copy to Klamath County Sheriff, to seek the common law protection of the sheriff and to preserve rights at law. Ultimate objective, the survival of a free people at law and the protection of our rights at law in the Republic of America. Status of the accused, a lawful inhabitant in the Republic of America. Clarification, the accused is not a citizen of the State of Oregon, nor is he a citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment. And then I've got some things in here about the possibility of filing a suit, although so far I have not, due to this paperwork, it has not been necessary to file suit, although I was prepared to do so. It says, remedy, file suit to invoke the common law protective powers of the county sheriff and to declare status. Said suit is under preparation. Now, there are different ways that you can go about that if you need to file a suit. You can use mandamus. You can use declaratory judgment. There's all kinds of different things which really aren't the subject of the state that you can do if they continue to pursue. But for the purposes of this state, what we're going to talk about is merely what the outcome of this case is so far and what we did to challenge the jurisdiction. Okay, now, I did appear in court. They did try to convert the initial appearance into an arraignment. The first day it didn't work. The first day, they told me that a judge, who I won't name, wanted to talk to me in his office. The next day I appeared and they tried to railroad arraign me. Okay? This can happen to you. And the judge was up there shooting some fiery darts at me. Remember we talked about fiery darts? Well, he was doing that. It was his intention to put me in jail. It was his intention to get me in a contempt situation and try to get me emotionally upset so that I couldn't function in the courtroom. And make a long story short, it didn't work. What they did was they entered a not guilty plea for me over my objection. Now, this can happen to you, and as you know, as they enter a not guilty plea for you, that is a jurisdictional move. It gets you past, remember we talked about the initial appearance and the arraignment? It gets you past that and into moving forward on the case. That's their intent. They know, realize, and understand that they must get you past that critical area in the beginning. Get you arguing after that, and now you're sitting there arguing, well, should I suppress the evidence? Is the state's witness lying? And all those kinds of things that are neither here nor there when you're challenging jurisdiction. That's what they would like you to do. And if you're not careful, you'll fall for it. Okay, so the judge entered a not guilty plea for me. And he sent me on my way. He sent me down to be booked in jail, which also occurred. Let's talk about this not guilty plea. If you fail to object timely to the entering of a not guilty plea, it is tantamount to consent to proceed forward to trial. And let me say that again. If you fail to object timely to the entry of a not guilty plea, you have just given them consent to proceed. You must object. All right? So I made up another... That the rationale is they put it in, you yank it out. Okay, that's how you do it. And see, you're running the show. Contrary to what they want you to believe, you're running the show. They just entered a not guilty plea into the file. Well, you just enter, they just yank it out. That's all. No big deal. You don't have to get excited. Here it is. In the District Court of the State of Oregon, blah, 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 caption. Direct objection to the entry of a not guilty plea, withdrawal of plea. I'll show you how this reads. Comes now the accused, Michael Benjamins, Jr., for the sole purpose of challenging jurisdiction, and hereby enters upon the record of the court the following. On the second day of October 1986 at approximately 9:45 a.m., the Honorable Judge Blank of the Circuit Court entered a not guilty plea over the objections of this accused. this accused never authorized the entry of said plea into the record. It was known by the court that this accused had a challenge of jurisdiction before the court, and that the entry of a not guilty plea would result in the attachment of jurisdiction. This is a violation of the rights of this accused to challenge jurisdiction. Now, here we come back again to what we talked about before. You have a right to challenge jurisdiction. It's not a privilege. It's not an immunity. It's a right. You can go in there and challenge jurisdiction, and you must assert it as a right. That's why I put in here. This is a violation of the rights of this accused to challenge jurisdiction. Wherefore, this accused hereby withdraws the plea of not guilty and enters no plea through the filing of this notice into the record, dated the 6th day of October 1986, Mike Benjamin Jr., the accused. Okay? You can do that. Now, you may not have been aware that you can do that, but you can do that. All right? It's what's in the record that counts. All right? Now, if the judge tries to strike it from the record, he's just compounding injury upon injury. All right? You have to realize that all the evidence that will ever be used against the judge will be provided by the judge. So you're going to have to see what he's up to and see where he's going with it. All right? Then the judge... Well, the court clerk gave me a piece of paper, and this is a release on my own recognizance, okay? And in Oregon, the paper looks something like pink. I got the pink sheet. But it has a bunch of little contractual little agreements that I won't leave the state, and that, I'll be a law-abiding citizen, and all kind of neat little things that are on here, okay? Well, they gave this to me to fill out. So what I did was, it says, general conditions on oath. First of all, I had to object to the oath. I took my pen out, I scratched out on oath, and I put solemn statement. So I'm not going to swear to affidavit or anything like that. On oath, I do hereby agree to appear at all times and places as ordered by any court, and then it says, having jurisdiction over prosecution. So what I did, I bracketed the words, having jurisdiction. See, this thing is worthless if the court has no jurisdiction. And it says right here, any court having jurisdiction. Well, I'm challenging jurisdiction. What that means is that if there's jurisdiction, then this is absolutely legal, lawful, and binding. If there's no jurisdiction, you can just throw it in the trash can because it's not worth anything. Okay? So I bracketed having jurisdiction, read on through, and I wrote on here, jurisdictional challenge held untainted. I wrote that on there. And then I put signed under threat, duress, and coercion. Okay? Then I signed it. Then the court clerk said, well, I don't know if the judge will sign that the way you've altered and changed and written on this. She took it to the judge. The judge looked at it, and he signed it after I signed it. Now we have an agreement that I was under threat, duress, and coercion, and that the jurisdictional challenge is held untainted, and that I'll have to agree to appear at all times and places of any court having jurisdiction. See how that works? There's no need to there's no need to sit in jail. Certainly not. You can get around it. Now, I can tell you that if I had not done this, I would be in jail. Well, I'm not going to be in jail unless I absolutely have no other choice but to be there. Because, frankly, I've got better things to do than sit in a jail, and I could be in jail right now instead of making a mistake. Put it that way. So you can see that it's rather important that you're not sitting in jail. Okay, we're going to take up a rather complicated subject matter next. And, we'll cover it, and then we'll take a break, and then we're going to take up the subject matter of what do you do? Do you appeal? What do you do if the court tries to rule on the jurisdiction itself and things like that? So the purposes of where we're at right now, let's talk about the different types of summonses that they can swing your way. Okay? Types of summonses. Well, number one, now I want to talk to you about an individual who had this happen to him just about the way it's written here, and that's this. He didn't appear. He was charged with an offense, and he didn't appear. He just filed the paperwork, which is, of course, an appearance. And at civil law, believe it or not, you do not have to appear personally. You can appear on paper. They sent to him a citation and complaint. he quashed the citation and complaint with the paperwork. Then they came back and they said, okay, we'll send you a notice of failure to appear or pay. Well, what that is another summons. What they do is they send you another summons in order so that they can get you to respond to one of the summonses that they send out to you. On this summons, it said that if you failed to appear to the notice of failure to appear, then they would issue a warrant. Well, a warrant is another summons. And that's when you have a big monkey come out with a badge on, and he enforces this new summons. Okay? So a warrant is a summons. A notice and demand of failure to appear or pay is a summons. And a citation and complaint is a summons. Okay, well, that didn't work, because we not only quashed the notice of failure to appear or pay, but we also quashed ahead of time the new summons called a warrant. So they didn't issue a warrant. Then they sent out a scheduling notice. And on this scheduling notice, it says, we're going to have a hearing on this jurisdictional issue that you've brought up about your notice and demand to quash the summons and complaint based on lack of jurisdiction. The only problem with the scheduling notice was, at the bottom it said, defendant is required to appear in person. So again, we have a summons. It's just another summons. So you can see how important this summons, and as we know from Pennoyer versus Neff, of course it's important. They have to have that summons, and they have to have service of process completed in order to lock in the jurisdiction. They were unsuccessful in doing this because they couldn't get the individual to appear in person and respond to the summons. But be that as it may, they sent four different summonses out, all under different disguises. This could happen to you. There are a lot of different forms that a summons can take. And this one, which didn't occur in this case I'm talking about, is any court order to appear is a summons. Remember, if a court has no jurisdiction of a person, he may ignore the proceedings. So what if a court issues a court order and he has no jurisdiction? Do you have to appear? No, you don't have to appear. It says literally you may ignore the proceedings. Now whether you want to appear or not is up to you. You'll have to make that decision. A court order to appear, got A, contempt hearing, B, show cause hearing. It's really up to you. We tried it both ways. I personally did appear. This other individual did not appear. And he, so far as the making of this tape, hasn't had any more trouble with his strategy than I have with mine. So that's where this is at. Now, what we recommend, like we said in the disclaimer, don't take my word for it. I don't want you to take my word for it. I want you to take the material that you see here that you get from the Remnant Church, and I want you to study it. I want you to evaluate it and find out whether these things are right or wrong. Find out if they're true or not true. And take the information and apply it yourself. We do not want you here to take our word for it. We don't want you to do it because Mike Benjamins Jr. said, this is what I should do, so this is what I'm going to do. I don't want the responsibility for you sitting... I want to emphasize this. I don't want the responsibility for you ending up like Joe Patriot here, and it says here, I want my rights, and here he is. I don't want to be the responsible party for you sitting in there. You be the responsible party. You want to be sovereign. You take the responsibility for your own actions. Now, you take the material that we've presented, and you study it out, and if you feel that this material is right, then you use it, and then you will be responsible if you make a mistake or do something wrong or you're not right before the Lord, and you end up like this. Okay? That's where we're at. So I think it's an opportune time here to take another break. And what we're going to do when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the difference between a jurisdictional bar and a jurisdictional challenge. And we're also going to talk about another move that you need to make, which has to do with permission and consent. Because remember, all the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. Even though you've gone in and quashed the summons and complaint, there's still a pitfall that you can fall into, and we're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. Okay? So let's take a break at this point, and we'll be back in 15 minutes or so. Come back from your break. We're now ready to take up the subject matter of the difference between a jurisdictional challenge and a jurisdictional bar. And for that, we'll go to the board. All right, now. For a jurisdictional challenge, this is what we've been using. Now, we have a stamp that says jurisdiction challenge. We stamp the complaint with this jurisdiction challenge stamp, and we came to find out that whenever we use the term jurisdictional challenge, they took it as a challenge requiring them to overcome and argue over the subject matter of the challenge, because we use the word challenge. The word challenge seems to have the connotation that you are inviting them to argue about the subject matter. Now, a jurisdictional bar is different. That is where they are barred from asserting their jurisdiction. It doesn't invite any argument. It doesn't invite them to rule on the issue. It doesn't invite any kind of further confrontations whatsoever. It just declares that there is a jurisdictional bar in the case. Now, if I get the cameraman to come back, we'll continue on. Now, what we have here is a stamp. This is a stamp here. It says jurisdictional bar declared. And this is what we're going to. We're no longer using the jurisdiction challenge stamp. I suppose there could be situations where we would use this stamp, but most cases it'll be this stamp, jurisdictional bar declared. So what we're saying here is that we do not want to invite the court to argue the situation, and that's what the word challenge seems to do. Now, generally, this is what's been happening in court cases where the jurisdiction of the court has been challenged. You file your papers, your guess is as good as mine to whether they read the papers or not, but you go before the judge, and the judge gets your papers before him, and he says, I see here, Mr. Patriot, Joe Patriot, that you have a document here entitled Jurisdictional Challenge. You say, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And he says, well, that's denied, and he just writes denied on it. And he puts it over here and says, now how do you plead to the charges? Well, there's a couple of things that have happened there. Number one, he has treated your jurisdictional challenge as a motion. Number two, he has taken jurisdiction he's assumed jurisdiction of the case. Number three, he has taken jurisdiction to rule on the jurisdiction motion. Okay? Now, I don't know if you fully understand what's happening here. Let's go back to this little phrase here on the board, and it says, all the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. All right? Well, then you have to ask yourself, well, how can that be? If all the jurisdiction used against me comes from me, how is he getting jurisdiction to rule on the jurisdiction? Now, what I'm saying, now it may sound a little confusing, but what I'm saying is that the court needs jurisdiction to rule on the jurisdictional issue. And they need your permission and consent to do that. Now, let me give you an analogy of how that would work. You see, they cannot move forward without your permission. So let me tell a little story and see if I can put it into perspective. A friend of mine, we'll call him Mr. A, I owe him $100. So Mr. A comes to me and he says, well, you owe me $100 and I want you to pay me. So I tell Mr. A, I says, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Why don't you come to my office next Wednesday? And on Wednesday, you bring all the paperwork with you and all the evidence that I owe you $100. And at that time on Wednesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to hear your case as to whether or not I owe you $100. And at the end of that time, I will rule whether or not I owe you $100. Is that okay? And he says, well, yeah, I'll show up on Wednesday. So Wednesday comes around 3 o'clock, and here he is. He presents his case. I consider his evidence, and I say, it is my ruling that I do not owe you $100. See you later. And he leaves. You see? Now, this goes back to the same kind of thing that we were looking at where they said they own all the wildlife. Well, what they're saying is, if you don't believe that I own all the wildlife, just ask me and I'll tell you. I own it. Same thing going on here. If you want a ruling as to whether or not I owe you anything, show up in my office on Wednesday and I'll give you my ruling. And it rules against it. I'll give you another example. You're a general or you're the leader of your army. You go to the opposing army who's bigger than you are and has more men than you do and has more tanks than you do and is more powerful than you are. You go to your enemy and ask him if it's okay to go ahead and go against him and fight him. You go to a sergeant in that army, or he's a representative of the army, and say, look, sergeant, is it okay with you guys if we go ahead and fight you and go against you? And the sergeant says, why don't you present your evidence on next Wednesday, and you will rule on as to whether or not you can fight us. So on Wednesday, we show up at the sergeant's office, and we say, okay, here's the evidence. You guys have done this. You're obstructing this. You're violating these rights that we have, and you're doing this, and you're doing that. And at the end of that, the sergeant says, well, your request is denied. We're not going to allow you to go against us. Then you say, well, I don't agree with you there. And he says, well, you know, if you don't agree with me, we do have a procedure where you can take your grievance to the lieutenant and you can appeal it up to the lieutenant in the same army. So you go, okay, well, I'll file a notice of appeal with the lieutenant and I'll take my case to him and see if it's okay up there whether or not I can go against you. And the lieutenant comes back and says, no, we affirm the lower decision of the sergeant and we're not going to allow you to go against us. So then you appeal it up to the captain, and then you appeal it up to the general, all the way to the general of that army, and the general refuses to hear the matter or simply affirms without decision, the decision of the lower court. So your problem here is that you are appealing your case to the same enemy that you're trying to go against. Obviously, he's going to go against you, all right? Now, we have a document here that we have made up, and I'm going to go through it, and it's a very interesting thing. See, they need your consent and your permission to rule on the jurisdictional issue that's before the court. Hence, we use jurisdictional bar, not jurisdictional challenge. But this is the problem. See, they need your consent and permission. If you show up to argue the thing, if you give them the idea that they have the power to rule on it, which they do not, unless you give it to them, then they will go ahead and rule against you. Now, let me show you what we've done here. The pleading is entitled, well, I'll go through the whole thing. It's in the District Court of the State of Oregon, same case number, same caption. Special appearance under threat, duress, and coercion for the sole purpose of challenging the court's jurisdiction in personam and in rem. Special notice denying consent and or permission for the plaintiffs to decide, rule upon or adjudicate the jurisdictional challenge statement of the accused. Now, at this time, I was still using jurisdictional challenge, but it really should read, special notice denying consent and or permission for the plaintiffs to decide, rule upon, or adjudicate the jurisdictional bar before the court. That's what it should read. Of course, we didn't have it down that way at this time. It starts out and it says, to all those to whom these presents shall come, know ye. Comes now the accused, Michael Benjamins Jr., in propria persona, without the assistance of unfettered counsel of choice, by special appearance, under threat, duress, and coercion, for the sole purpose of challenging jurisdiction in personam and in rem, and specially files this notice denying consent and or permission for the plaintiff to decide, rule upon, or adjudicate the jurisdictional challenge / statement of the accused as follows. This accused, in and by enhancing the doctrine of sovereignty, lawful status, jurisdictional immunity, has taken lawful steps to establish a lack of jurisdiction in this case. Jurisdiction is being asserted by the state of Oregon. Now remember that it's the state of Oregon plaintiff against me. Okay, what does that mean? Well, that means that the whole army was the other army's adversary, the whole state of Oregon is my adversary, all right? Jurisdiction is being asserted by the state of Oregon plaintiffs in this case. All persons and or agencies which are involved or will be involved, acting in a state capacity, are part of the jurisdiction so asserted. This would, of necessity, include all Oregon courts and tribunals at the trial and appellate levels. Therefore, this accused denies any and all consent and or permission, expressed or implied, for this court or and any other Oregon court to rule upon, decide, decree, adjudge, or otherwise adjudicate the jurisdictional challenge statement in the court file. All right? Said court file is by this reference made part hereof. No jurisdiction exists in the absence of consent and or permission for said Oregon courts to in any way dispose of the jurisdictional bar on record. This special appearance of this accused are not to be construed as acquiescence to the court for the preliminary or final disposition of the jurisdictional challenge statement on file. Dated this such and such a day, respectfully submitted Michael Benjamins, Jr., the accused, impropria persona a layman. Now what we're saying here, it is just as ridiculous to go to the Court of Appeals of this state, or any of the appellate courts, to have them rule upon my jurisdictional challenge, to have them say, no, we don't have any jurisdiction, you're a sovereign, you're a free man, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's just as ridiculous to go to them and ask them to make that decree as it is to go to the lieutenant of the opposing army and say, is it okay if I fight you guys? And they say, no, it isn't okay. Go over there and shut up, and we'll deal with you later. And we're going to move forward here. We're not going to put up with any of your rhetoric having to do with your free man and all that kind of stuff. You see what I mean? Okay, so that's what we have to realize here. And you can get that from the fact that all the jurisdiction used against you comes from you. Now, this flyer is going to be included with this tape in the paperwork packet, and I would recommend that you copy this and put it all over the place in your house or in your office so that you don't ever forget it, so that you realize that that is a situation that you're involved in. Okay, now, we are going to take up the subject matter of extraterritoriality. That's kind of an interesting subject matter, and for that I think I'm going to have to go to the board here. Before I take that up, I think I'll talk about what's written on the board first. And that is, there's a little statement here. In order to assert a proper jurisdictional challenge as a free man, you have to remember that you must have broken all the minimum contacts, all the nexus with the system. And that means that you have to be in a position where they cannot assert against you the in rem attachment of the subject matter over the person. And an explanation of that is the res, the subject matter of the contract, which they have jurisdiction over, the attachment of that subject matter over your person has to be broken. Okay? That's basically what we're talking about. Now, extraterritoriality. Let me erase the board here and we'll address that. What I'm going to do is just write it on the board, spell it out for you, then we're going to read it out of Black's Fourth Law Dictionary, and then after that we're going to discuss it a little bit. Extraterritoriality. The definition from Black's Fourth Law Dictionary is the privilege of those persons, such as foreign ministers, who, though temporarily resident within a state, are not subject to the operation of its laws. The exemption from the operation of the ordinary laws of the state accorded to foreign monarchs temporarily within the state and their retinue, to diplomatic agents and the members of their household, to consuls in non-Christian states, and to foreign men of war in port. Extraterritoriality. Now what they're saying here is that there are people of such a status that the ordinary laws of the system where they find themselves do not attach to them. Now this is of course something that we want. We are in reality ambassadors for our own nation, because a nation is a group of people who believe and live by a certain belief. Okay, that's what a nation is. Now, what I'm going to explain here on the board is this. If you have, here's the system. Here are the sovereign people, the ones who have reestablished themselves as sovereigns by status. A group of people like that forms a nation. Look up the definition of nation in the Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the English Language, and you'll find that this is true. Now you have a nation of sovereigns, a republic, if you want to call it that. Now, if these individuals leave this arena and go over into the system, they are, in fact, ambassadors for their nation. And when they are in the system, they have the right of extraterritoriality, which means that the ordinary laws of the system where they find themselves do not attach to them. They're exempt from those laws. And that's why it is absolutely necessary that we form a separate entity of sovereign people by status, and that we become ambassadors for that group. Okay? At this point, I think this is an opportune time to take another break.
Okay, that concludes the tape. The rest of it is some advertising about some other things that he wants to sell. But this will conclude this tape at this point.